and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening in. If you would like to support this podcast, you can become a patron of this show by making a small monthly contribution through my Patreon page. To do that, you can either search for me on patreon.com or use the link in the upper right-hand corner of my website, kunstler.com. Well, Dmitry Orlov is back with me today to discuss his new book, Shrinking the Technosphere, which you can order at his website, cluborlov.com. That's one word, cluborlov.com. Dmitry's a wonderful writer with a marvelously sly sense of humor, and he's a leading voice in the effort to think clearly about the predicaments of our time. So kick back and give a listen to his latest ideas about the beast called the technosphere, which is trying to swallow our humanness. So I'm here with Dmitry Orlov on this beautiful fall morning, and we're going to talk about Shrinking the Technosphere, which is Dmitry's new book. When's it going to be published?
Well, people can already order the book, so the exact timing is not really an issue.
Okay, good. Well, modernity is starting to look a little out of date, isn't it? And the technosphere is sort of its love child. Would you tell us about what the technosphere is and how it operates?
Well, I started by thinking that basically there's some kind of an intelligence that is a property of the technical realm as opposed to the humans that are supposedly in charge of it. And I had that feeling for a long time that basically we're dealing with a machine that doesn't have an off switch and we can't really affect what it does very much. It has an agenda of its own. And then most recently over the past year and a half, the whole idea gelled in my mind to a point where I started seeing it, and after researching it quite a bit, I understood it to be a sentient entity made up of many moving parts, only some of them human. A lot of them are now internet servers and algorithms running on internet servers that control most aspects of our lives, control us in just about every possible way, down to preventing us from committing crimes by computers detecting the likelihood of us committing a crime before we've even thought of it. And that this entity is basically on a collision course with the biosphere, which is the living planet that we need in order to survive, and that it's a fight to the death. So we do have to get involved. And then I found out that there is a way for us to get involved that is not revolutionary or radical. It's very incrementalist. And I came up with a method called the harm-benefit analysis that allows us to wrest control of our technology back from the technosphere so that technology once again serves us as opposed to us serving it.
Yeah, well, isn't there an element in all this of the human race being dragged kicking and screaming out of the technosphere, whether we like it or not, perhaps? Because, well, let me just say that I got an email a few weeks ago from a publisher who told me that he was putting out Ted Kaczynski's new book. And Ted Kaczynski, listeners might remember, is the Unabomber, who is now locked up in the Supermax prison in Colorado. And the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, is coming out with a new book called The Anti-Tech Revolution. And his view of it is that the technosphere is actually a booby-trapped organism that is kind of, it does have an agenda, but it's also kind of booby-trapped for self-destruction.
Oh, I entirely agree with that. I'm amazed that Ted is coming out with a new book because all of his writings, last I heard, were embargoed until mid-century.
Well, I had heard the same thing, and I was a little confused by it, too, and I'm not sure how that's working, but I do actually have the book on my desk here, and it seems to be written in his style. Yeah, I remember a few years ago, well, it was more than a few years ago, but when the Unabomber's Manifesto came out, and it was printed, I believe, in the New York Times because Kaczynski was coercing the media into publishing his thoughts promising to, you know, kill more people or send more bombs out. So they published it. But a friend of mine who works on an Ivy League campus told me at the time that his fellow professors were walking around campus that day, you know, going right on, right on, you know, agreeing with what Ted Kaczynski was saying.
Well, yes, in the popular imagination, he's a paranoid schizophrenic. In reality, he is a brilliant thinker who resorted to terrorist, unsound, let me put it this way, unsound but effective terrorist methods to get his message out. He was sort of a boutique terrorist. You know, he practiced terrorism on an artisanal, non-industrial scale. you know, you can say whatever you want about him, you know, maiming a few people and killing a few people. But the fact that he's still being studied on university campuses and, you know, is still working is quite significant, I think. And not having read his book, I think that I will agree with him. I think I would put it differently. I would say that the technosphere is suicidal without realizing it because of certain mental deficiencies it has.
Yeah,
it's not suicidal on purpose.
Not out of pure malice.
No, not at all.
But it appears that one of the main booby traps to the technosphere's agenda is that it pursues infinite growth on a finite planet.
Well, it can't see physical limits. That's its problem. It is incapable of seeing physical limits. And then when it does hit them, it always treats them as a financial problem. Mm-hmm. And the idea becomes that, well, if you throw enough money at something, you know, the problem can be remedied. So now the plan is, okay, we're in a situation where oil consumers can't pay what it costs to produce oil. And oil producers can't sell it for what it costs them to produce oil. The solution is to print money and hand it out to the producers and to the consumers so that they can keep producing and consuming. Well, what that does is it basically hollows out the entire capital structure of the economy until the whole thing becomes a pyramid scheme.
Mm-hmm. You say that the technosphere operates or seems to operate as a kind of an organism with a survival strategy of its own, apart from human values. And this being apart from human values is one of the huge problems associated with it.
Well, yes, its approach to humans is perfectly functional. So in some situations, it's useful to make humans proud and happy and fulfilled. If, for instance, they work at Google, that's the right approach, or at Apple. But if you're really just using them as some kind of cannon fodder, then it doesn't matter whether they're happy or not. So then fear and dependency are much better techniques to try. You can make humans feel that they're free and exercising their freedom of expression and free will in one social setting. But in another social setting, you might coerce people to follow a very highly regimented religious theocratic order. These are all techniques, and technique is neutral. It's value neutral. So to say that there are such things as human values that are somehow built into the technosphere, that is not true.
Mm-hmm. You're a pretty funny writer, and it's one of the things I appreciate about your books. You refer to our current space program as a, quote, idiotic, megalomaniacal techno-fantasy, which is something I agree with. And I'm astounded when I see people like Elon Musk and even Stephen Hawking lately promoting this idea that we must have a mission to Mars. We haven't even demonstrated that we can live on this planet.
Yeah, it's true. Well, we can live on this planet, but we're destroying, actively destroying our chance of surviving on this planet because we are beholden to the technosphere. But as far as space exploration, it has pretty much been reduced to flying widgets into outer space and taking pictures and poking around. Landing on planets is still a very dicey proposition.
It's a good place for robots, but not necessarily for humans.
Exactly. But the robots are being tasked to look for signs of life, ideally intelligent life, because the technosphere needs a biosphere to infest. if it's just widgets by themselves, then, you know, robots aren't that interesting to each other. The technosphere is interested in manipulating life, and so it always looks for life to manipulate. But overall, it's an attempt to showcase technology with the help of science. Science has been reduced from an open-ended quest in search of understanding and wisdom to a way of showcasing cutting-edge technology. And it's an example of looking for the car keys under the street lamp, where you might see them, you know, the car keys being technology and, you know, and the street lamp being giant government grants of various kinds.
These fantasies that we have about going into space and you know, related ones like self-driving cars and electrifying the whole motoring system, these seem to be connected to the blind faith in progress that the technosphere demands of us.
Well, yes, because the suppositions that drive the whole program is that technology is good, that newer technology is better than older technology, that more technology is better than less technology, and that anybody who opposes this is basically out of date and should be ignored. So every effort is made in that direction to enforce those principles. And one way to do that is to basically paint a dire picture the moment this stops working. So there's really no vision of, you know, reducing the scope of technology to a reasonable level. There's no idea of an optimum level of technological development beyond which you get diminishing returns with regard to technology. Instead, there's this idea of the apocalypse. There is a little bit of truth to it, because the way the technosphere proceeds is each time it comes up with a new way of doing something, it destroys the old way of doing it. Mm-hmm. So there, it cannot move backwards. It can only move forwards. It doesn't have a reverse gear. And so it would be an apocalypse for the technosphere to force it to go back. But that doesn't mean that we'll be instantly deprived of all technology, and it doesn't mean that we'll immediately die.
Well, you also say that the technosphere tends to create more problems than it can solve. And tell us how that works.
Yes, it creates a constant overhang of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. One of the things that it absolutely hates is the precautionary principle, which is the idea that until you have quantified all the potential harm from a new type of technology, you just shouldn't use it. Instead, the idea is that, well, we'll do whatever we want, unless it's immediately fatal, and then we'll deal with whatever consequences later. So we'll build nuclear power plants with having no idea how to sequester the high-level radioactive waste, and not even thinking about how much that's going to cost. We'll start feeding antibiotics to farm animals and not care at all about the fact that the antibiotics will stop working because we do that. You know, there's any number of issues like that. Nanotechnology is great. We'll use it in food packaging. What happens to the nanoparticles that are insoluble in water and can pass through the blood-brain barrier and cause brain damage in higher animals once it gets out into the environment? Well, you know, we'll somehow deal with it later. And so there's a giant overhang of non-existent technologies. One place to see them on display is the Fukushima Daiichi installation in Japan, where there's no way to stop water, radioactive water contaminated with high-level waste leaking out into the ocean. There is no way to find out where the nuclear fuel went, because it's too radioactive for humans and it's too radioactive for robots. Those are just two examples. There are others. But what we have now is a large number of technologies that should exist in order to mitigate the negative effects of technologies that do exist.
The scientist James Lovelock devised the Gaia theory of the biosphere. And you regard the technosphere as being an anti-Gaia organism. And it behaves kind of pathologically. How does the technosphere become psychopathic or harbor or promote psychopathic behavior in humans?
Well, those are kind of two different questions. The reason for comparing the technosphere to Gaia is because Gaia is a living system that maintains the homeostatic equilibrium of the planet. It restores ocean salinity and atmospheric oxygen concentrations and temperature after volcanic explosions, meteor strikes, etc. It can compensate for all sorts of calamities and restore the planet to a balance, a homeostatic equilibrium at which life can thrive in all of its multitude of forms. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the technosphere is completely incapable of maintaining homeostatic equilibrium. Right now, it is busy making oceans acidic while overheating the planet, and will probably end up making it quite radioactive as well. So it is a sort of anti-Gaia because it is in a permanent runaway mode. It cannot actually achieve any sort of equilibrium within itself. It's a system that maintains a constant disequilibrium.
And so we really need to be concerned about this.
Well, yes, it's a matter of life and death. It's a matter of death and death. It's a matter of relative death. If the technosphere fails, then a lot of us will die because, as I detail in the book, we're very highly dependent on it. A lot of people wouldn't be able to survive without it. Uh-huh. But if the technosphere wins, then we all die.
All right. And you have a way of understanding how this works out called the harm-benefit ratio. Why don't you explain that to the listeners?
Well, the harm-benefit analysis is a system that I have come up with. There are 32 different criteria to evaluate any given piece of technology to figure out how harmful it is and how beneficial it is. You end up all the harmful attributes and all the beneficial attributes. These are ways of looking at making technology serve you as opposed to you serving it. All of those criteria drive in that direction. They're all aspects of technology that either, you know, if they're harmful, then they deprive you of self-sufficiency and freedom. And if they're beneficial, then they enhance your self-sufficiency and freedom, make you more independent of the technosphere. So looked at in that light, every given piece of technology can be evaluated, and you can make rational choices, not being very extreme. It can even be as basic as figuring out what kind of car to buy. You know, if you're forced to drive, mm-hmm. then you might as well do a good job of choosing the right kind of car. But in the end, what the end result of applying that analysis across the board will be is that the technosphere will be made less internally efficient. And because it's a machine-like intelligence, you know, where the ends always justify the means, it will curtail its operations because it will realize that it is not achieving its purpose, its agenda, mm-hmm. and will shrink. So the shrinkage will be more or less automatic by ratcheting down our use of technology using this harm-benefit analysis.
Well, isn't it a fact anyway that the technosphere faces some severe challenges in the resource scarcity that we face and also our inability to form real capital, to really accumulate real wealth as opposed to the fake nominal wealth that we see reflected in markets and things?
Oh, that is absolutely the case. But it's also a problem of scale. So looking at it from a human perspective, you know, we're looking at a humanitarian disaster. Mm-hmm. Looking at it from the technosphere's point of view, you know, what the heck is a humanitarian disaster and who are these humans anyway? Cluttering up the planet. So, you know, you make them into fertilizer and you use that to grow food for your servants, who are the engineers and the technologists and the people who serve them.
One of the interesting ideas that you put out here is the idea that the whole apparatus of political correctness and so-called progressive thinking are actually in the service of the technosphere including such features of contemporary life as the destruction of the family and the destruction of gender roles, etc. So tell us a little bit about how that works.
Well, one of the things that the technosphere finds almost completely indigestible and, throws just limitless resources at destroying is the clan, clan-like groups of people who are, basically very tight-knit separatist societies that look out for each other and are willing to die for each other and cannot be dominated as individuals because they deal with the rest of the world as a group, as representatives of a group. Mm-hmm. This is something that is completely indigestible to the technosphere, and so it destroys it. So you can see the ongoing action in Afghanistan, for instance, and in the tribal areas of Pakistan as an all-out effort to destroy these tribes, which happen to be quite, these Pashtun tribes are just completely indestructible people. They've been there for thousands of years. They're one of the largest, most successful ethnic groups on the planet, and they're very resistant, incredibly resistant. But that is what the technosphere tries to fight. So it eliminates tribes and clans, and then it eliminates extended families by breaking them up. So that you just have the nuclear family, and then it destroys the nuclear family as well by making fathers redundant, by structuring things so that basically men don't really play an economic role, a positive economic role. Mm-hmm. There's a number of ways that that's done, and then the last frontier is eliminating motherhood. So mothers have to work. And then they put their kids in subsidized, substandard daycare, and their children grow up as strangers. Mm-hmm. So the last step is to deprive people of having a parent and basically making them wards of the technosphere from a young age.
And the net effect is to alienate and isolate individuals so that they really have no contact with any kind of a nourishing group.
That's right. The final frontier is all human relations are mediated through some computer algorithm that the technosphere controls. So people don't actually interact face-to-face. They interact through a computer or through social media where they can just basically be herded in some direction that is desirable for the technosphere.
One of the ideas that you put out in this book that's very appealing to me is this notion of nature-like technologies. And these are ways of doing things that are necessary to keep civilization going that are more congenial to the biosphere. Could you tell us a little bit about nature-like technologies?
Well, yes. That's pretty much all there was at the beginning. In the beginning, our technology, which predates the existence of the Homo sapiens. Homo habilis was the one that came up with a way of sharpening rocks, and that was something like 2.5 million years ago. But during most of our existence as a species, and during most of the existence of these hominids, tool-using hominids that preceded us, the technology that we used, advanced very slowly, and it was basically a way of existing within the natural realm. It wasn't a way of modifying the natural realm, and it wasn't a way of creating an artificial realm for us to inhabit. Those things came much later. So as we regress down the technology hierarchy, we can't go all the way back because we need things like clothing and shelter and cooked food, weapons. Those are all forms of technology. But as we regress, the technologies that we can once again embrace are those that resemble nature, that cause zero harm, that have analogs in the animal world, animal kingdom, and that can be sustained perpetually.
Part of your thesis is that the technosphere is almost certainly going to fail one way or another. And this raises the question that when and if that happens and how that happens, the human race is going to find itself resetting to some other level of activity. I've been putting over this trope for the last year or so about Japan being the first advanced nation to, quote, go medieval. But it does raise the question, you know, where do we stop? Are we going to go medieval? Are we going to go 18th century? Are we going to go Stone Age? What's possible in the level of civilization that we might be able to reset to?
Well, my feeling is that we'll go timeless, that this won't resemble any given period in history. We know at this point we have a lot more knowledge and understanding of the world than we had even 100 years ago. We also have various artifacts in our world, such as toxic waste dumps and, you know, radioactive stockpiles, et cetera, that we didn't have 100 years ago. All of these things will require different coping mechanisms from those who want to survive. We can't really just go back, you know. The dream of us being able to exist within a, you know, a lifestyle that existed even 100 years ago is now an impossibility. So it will be a combination of very simple nature-like adaptations. I think a lot of people will actually be quite a bit happier growing their own food or hunting and fishing, building their own shelter. Things like that are very, very normal. But in the mental space that people will still occupy, there will be a lot more than existed 100 years ago because of just of the complexity of the situation that we'll be forced to deal with.
Another thing that you bring up is what you call the stopping problem. Tell us about that.
Well, yes, we have to draw boundaries on our use of technology, and the technosphere will forever try to prevent us from doing exactly that. So we have to figure out when enough is enough. If we use electronic communication, when do we stop? Do we stop at having, you know, a few computers at the community library that, you know, we can use once in a while? Or do we have to have some mobile computing device that's on the network 24/7? Or do we go all the way to a neural implant that is, you know, screwed into a socket that is in one of our molar teeth or something, where we don't even have to use our eyes and ears anymore because electronic signals are fed directly into our brain, you know? Yeah. Do we beam ourselves up to some kind of a computer cluster that so that we don't even have to have a body, which is one of the, you know, fantasies of the singularitarian movement? You know, you have to figure out when enough technology is enough. And it's a, you know, it's a difficult task because our habits have been formed by having too much technology, and having not enough technology seems life-threatening and uncomfortable.
Well, it seems to me that you're suggesting that to some degree it's like we're facing a smorgasbord of technology and we get to choose the ones that we're going to retain. Is that in fact what you think? And I wonder if In fact, we're going to lose a lot more than we're even prepared to imagine. For example, I have a hard time seeing large-scale electric grids being maintainable very far into the future. And if that's the case, you know, we're not going to have an internet. So is it a smorgasbord, or are we just going to be kind of just shoved out of it?
Well, look, you can have the internet, right? And that is very expensive in terms of energy. It's very capital consuming. It employs a great number of people, et cetera. It's a huge entity. Mm-hmm. And then, suppose you have some kind of a village somewhere up in the mountains, right? And there are some solid state electronic components, some solar panels, et cetera, and some fairly robust computing devices, probably military surplus, because that's one place where you don't have planned obsolescence. And so that allows you to provide a gigantic library of music, film, books, you name it, all available to all the people in this village. Now, that is just a remarkable wealth that no village 100 years ago could have imagined. Mm-hmm. And now the whole thing can be put together for small change, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. For the price of a small collection of books, 100 years ago, you can now have pretty much the Library of Congress at your fingertips. And that is a remarkable achievement. So in terms of harm-benefit analysis, yeah, there is some harm because, you know, non-renewable natural resources were consumed in generating this technology. On the other hand, a lot of it can come from surplus, and if you reuse something, then it causes less harm than something that has to be manufactured for the purpose. Mm-hmm. It can be made extremely long-lasting. That's where commercial-grade and military-grade products come in because, you know, unlike consumer-level products, they're not based on the principle of planned obsolescence and can be made to last for a really long time and be maintainable. So there are a lot of different types of technology to explore and to exploit in every sphere. There are a lot of choices to be made. So to fight the technosphere on this level without depriving yourself of useful technology, one does have to become a certain kind of technologist, but not the mainstream kind that tries to make products that sell.
So to some degree, just, you know, the money is at the root of many of the problems of the technosphere.
Yes, money is a giant impediment for just about everybody, because what the technosphere does is set up a system where it ruins our ability to save and to do anything other than buy the recommended commercial consumer-grade products.
Well, it turns us into slaves in a way.
Yes,
and describe that process.
Well, it's not exactly a process; it's an end result. Basically, when we cannot exercise any amount of choice over what technology we use and how much of it we use, we become slaves to technology. You know, we become addicts, technology addicts. It's as simple as that.
Well, we're also hostages to what you call the Iron Triangle.
Yes, well, that's an economic arrangement that I've been writing about for quite a while now. If you have a setup where you have to have a place to live, which costs more and more, that's one of the main ways that people are enslaved, is by making them pay exorbitant amounts for a crappy little stick-nailed box. And to pay for it, you have to have a job. And to get to that job, you have to have a car. Then that's the Iron Triangle. You knock out any vertex of that triangle and the whole thing falls apart. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing is structured in such a way that your ability to come up with any significant amount of savings so that you can execute your own plan that doesn't involve the Iron Triangle is impossible or very difficult. Mm-hmm. It is still possible for some people, you know, but it requires quite a bit of ingenuity and initiative.
In Ted Kaczynski's book, he makes the kind of clarion call for revolution, not reform. But in your book, you ask, who will the revolutionaries be and what is the plan? Can you talk to us a little about what that is?
Yes, well, you know, Ted Kaczynski is the only revolutionary I know of, mm-hmm. and he's in jail. Mm-hmm. So I guess the revolutionary movement is kind of on the rocks. Also, if you look at Ted Kaczynski's own critique of the bourgeois political realm, he pretty much dismisses both the liberal and the conservative sides as completely useless to this task.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't you do that to some extent, too?
Well, actually, I relied on his analysis, which is, really incisive. Basically, what he says is that, you know, the liberals, they basically champion those that they secretly consider inferior. Minorities of various kinds, you know, various types of victimized populations, etc. Mm-hmm. But these are, you know, basically, you know, the entire liberal side of the spectrum is dominated by well-educated, prosperous white males who are, in their own mind, superior to the people, you know, the little people whose causes they champion. And it results in a certain syndrome that Kaczynski calls over-socialization, which is basically people are always looking at each other for approval and are unable to see things for themselves. They cannot see anything outside of this, you know, kind of inbred social realm where everybody has to agree with one another. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's as far as the liberals. As far as the conservatives, basically he points out that conservatism is completely stupid because conservatives embrace economic progress, not seeing that economic progress is what destroys everything they're trying to conserve.
Right. And you have a way of describing politics as political technologies. I would regard these political technologies actually as rackets. And many of them are the common and obvious ones that we have to contend with every day, the medical racket, the college loan racket, the two-party political racket, the military-industrial arms manufacturers racket. How did these things turn into rackets rather than just useful activities?
Oh, well, you know, the technosphere as a whole is a parasite upon the biosphere, you know, that is eating away at it, destroying it, chewing it up, and killing it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so within that whole scheme of one gigantic parasite, you have sub-parasites. So this pattern of parasitism, you know, is fractal. It exists on every level. So on some level, it may look like a racket, but on a larger scale, it looks like parasitism. But the pattern is always the same. It's the parasite slowly destroying its host.
It does amaze me that the American public is having a relatively hard time even perceiving these activities as rackets. For example, I would have thought by now that the reaction to what's going on in medical care would have gotten people marching with the pitchforks and torches, but it hasn't really happened. They're just, you know, they're being so obviously screwed. We are being so obviously screwed by things like, you know, $5,000 deductible medical insurance policies and, you know, pharmaceuticals that cost $10,000 a pill to get over some illness. How do you explain the amazing apathy and complacency of the American public these days?
Well, it can be explained on all sorts of levels. Part of the political machinery is making people feel that there is no other choice, or that the choice that they're being forced to make is the only, you know, the only good positive one. Mm-hmm. So, in order to make them, you know, deal and comply with the medical racket, you have to convince them that it is the only reasonable way to organize medicine, that everything else is communism or something. I've had some really funny conversations with one recently was with a doctor, a retired physician, who was just couldn't be stopped from talking on and on about how ashamed he is of the medical system in the United States on every level. Mm-hmm. He said doctors are no longer being trained as doctors. They're now sort of, you know, they know a little bit about medicine, but mostly they're just technicians with a minor in finance and law. You know, he just went on and on about that and telling me horror stories about all of these people that he knows that got chewed up by the system, basically because they were dealing with people who were impersonating doctors instead of being doctors. They're basically just button pushers. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, you know, there's a pretty simple solution. If you have a medical problem, you don't have to deal with American doctors. And he looked at me and, you know, didn't understand what I was saying. And I said, well, you just go to the post office over there and apply for a passport, and then you get on the internet and buy a ticket to Havana. Stunned silence. I mean, he just couldn't continue the conversation past that point. Mm-hmm. I just brought up something that just completely burst his bubble, because he exists in a world where there are no other alternatives. So what we have is bad, but nothing else can possibly exist.
Mm-hmm.
He can't countenance the fact that there's an entire world out there where doctors are still doctors.
Well, one of the things you're describing in this scenario are terrible social tensions. And, you know, they're there whether the technosphere likes it or not. And for one thing, they seem to be expressing themselves in the incredibly squalid election that is taking place now in 2016. And where do Trump and Hillary fit into your view of the political technologies?
Well, Hillary is basically some kind of like an ectoplasmic projection of the technosphere. She's not even human at this point. I mean, she stands there at a podium delivering, some verbiage that is probably piped into her brain through a thing in her ear. Uh-huh. I doubt that she actually like speaks like normal humans speak. It doesn't sound human, you know? Uh-huh. And then on the other side, you have this enfant terrible, whose function is basically to destroy, mm-hmm. to drain the swamp, as he says it. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. If enough people actually go and do the only thing they still can, which is vote, and do it en masse, then, you know, he will drain the swamp.
Can you actually imagine Donald Trump competently heading the federal government? Because I have quite a bit of trouble imagining that.
Nobody can possibly competently head an incompetent organization.
Well, can he be president and not crash that whole system?
No, nobody can be president and not crash the system. It'll crash.
So do you, I mean, I have a sense that the system is actually in the process of going through kind of a slow train wreck. And, you know, I called it the long emergency for a reason. What's your idea of how this is proceeding vis-a-vis the election this year?
Well, there's a lot of people, different kinds. For instance, military officers and the enlisted men who are not very happy with Obama and not very happy with anyone Obama would endorse. A lot of them actually at this point, if you talk to them, consider the federal government as an illegitimate entity.
Oh, gosh. That's pretty extreme.
And this is officers. And these are officers who saw quite a bit of action that I've spoken to. These are not like armchair warriors. They're people who've done a lot of service in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Somalia. So, yeah, so that doesn't bode well.
Well,
and then there's
one of my ideas over the last year has been that if Trump did get elected, there's a pretty good chance he would be removed in a coup d'etat by the military.
Why?
For the reasons that you pretty much just stated, that you know, that they'd be afraid that he'd smash it up, that he'd smash things up, and that they need, somebody who could actually, manage the job in there.
Yeah, but there's not really a job to manage because, you know, if you talk to a lot of these military people, they sort of just shake their head and think that, you know, the entire military strategy pursued by the country is, you know, non-functional. And, you know, just about anybody will tell you that. So if Trump tries to start a war, then yes. If Trump doesn't try to start a war, then what difference does it make?
Yeah. Well, you actually have a chapter that describes the sort of human dynamics in this whole picture, your chapter on social machines. And one of the points that you make is that it's very hospitable to psychopathic personalities, the technosphere.
Well, yes, the whole thrust of the technosphere, because it's not a human entity, it's a machine-like intelligence, is to eliminate all human elements from it, you know, things like compassion, things like, you know, the ability to use your intuition and your subjective judgment, and it tries to make everybody into a rule-following automaton. So bureaucracies and corporations are basically entities designed to make people into rule-following automatons. And what happens is that certain kinds of people are much better at not being human than others, and nobody is better at not being human than a psychopath, because they don't really have these impediments of, you know, feeling compassion for somebody, or, you know, having an intuition in terms of how somebody is best handled. They'll just follow rules blindly. They're perfectly happy to exist within a dehumanizing environment, because they're not altogether human themselves. So corporations and societies in general, societies dominated by social machines, are basically psychopath incubators. If you think about the fact that, you know, people rise through the ranks in various hierarchical organizations based on their propensity to act like psychopaths, and they do well economically, and therefore their progeny does well economically, then what you're doing is you're conducting a selective breeding experiment in making a lot of psychopaths. And it's known that psychopathy is 50% genetic. So a few generations later, you have a society that is pretty much stocked with psychopaths, and they all occupy the higher echelons.
Yeah, because they're succeeding so well and they're reproducing their kind.
That's right, exactly. And so when that fails, there is really nothing to go back to, because outside of social machines, psychopaths are basically damaged goods. Nobody wants them around. So we'll have to just basically wait for all of these, you know, formerly successful elites to, I don't know, kill themselves or die or something. Uh-huh. Before, you know, the gene pool returns to normal.
Well, there's perhaps even a higher iteration of psychopath that you call a robopath. And what is the robopath? How does it work? How does it function?
Well, that's the opposite, which is basically normal people, when they're stuck inside a social machine, they suffer psychological damage. And one of the compensation mechanisms that they arrive at is to become sticklers for rules. Mm-hmm. That's the only way they can suppress their humanity, is by claiming that the rules are the rules. And then they have this newfound sense of identity and self-worth that is all based on their ability to blindly follow rules.
An awful lot like you're describing Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s.
Oh, it happens everywhere. It's not, there are some extreme cases, but this happens in just about any bureaucratic organization.
Yeah, I was about to say either Nazi Germany or the New York State Motor Vehicle Bureau.
Well, yes, it very well describes a lot of the police departments in the United States. Uh-huh. Lots of robopaths. And in fact, the you can gauge the level of robopathic infestation within society by the amount of police violence. Uh-huh. So basically, the robopaths, they have this kind of new fragile identity. If that identity is shattered, then what you end up with is a radically estranged, hyper-alienated individual, indistinguishable from, basically just an insane person.
That actually seems to be where we're at in the USA these days, with enormous numbers of people who are mentally ill, strung out on drugs, obese, unable to cope. Is that the final journey of the robopath?
The final journey is rather interesting, because these social machines, they fail to work. At some point, they just basically, the rules stop working. Uh-huh. Okay. And then what happens is the psychopaths that at the top, who are the, you know, la crème de la crème of American society, they start making up their own rules as they go along. And you definitely see that. So, you know, first example was in banking. Ever since 2008, there are really no banking laws. And eventually you start seeing it in all kinds of other places. And foreign policy and international law doesn't exist anymore, completely disregarded. So basically the psychopaths start following their own rules. Mm-hmm. And imagine what that does to the robopaths below them. It robs them of their treasured sense of identity. You can't be a stickler for rules that keep changing or that don't exist. So basically, suddenly, all of the robopaths down below become schizophrenic.
Oh. Well, you saw something like this happen in the fall of the Soviet Union, which you actually described very beautifully in your first book, Reinventing Collapse. And the remarkable thing about that to me, 20 years later, is that it happened so suddenly and relatively bloodlessly, too. Does that strike you as an interesting feature of that particular outcome?
Well, there are quite a few elements to that. One was that basically it was an unsustainable scheme because the Soviet Union couldn't get agriculture right because of the legacy of collectivization and the destruction of village life. And because of that, it went further and further into debt with the West. And in the end, it's the creditors who called the shots. Mm-hmm. And second, the communist elite was internally compromised. They were basically looking for perks. They weren't looking to perpetuate the system. So basically, there was systemic corruption, not just like little elements of corruption. The whole thing was corrupt.
Well, how psychopathic was that?
It varied. Some people were just cynical. I don't know that, Russia had the same kind of a psychopathic, breeding experiment as the more prosperous capitalist countries. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure about that. As far as being robopaths, Russians make very bad robopaths.
Why is that?
Well, you can't just convince Russians that, personal judgment and initiative are to be reduced. To a Russian, any rule that can't be bent must be broken. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. So even if they're following rules, they do so grudgingly. The Russians are very good at doing things grudgingly for thousands of years. And you just can't break them down. The national character is too strong. So I don't think that played that big a role there. But the last element of the Soviet collapse, why it was swift and relatively bloodless, was that, on the one hand, you had political traitors like Gorbachev and Yeltsin that basically happily sold off the country to the highest bidder. And on the other hand, the people were enamored of the idea of being embraced by the West and having jeans and bubblegum and, rock and roll. That didn't last very long. Uh-huh. That lasted for a generation, maybe. And now there's a kind of a counter process to that.
What is that counter process? I'm just curious, since you brought it up.
Oh, it's this popular idea of Russian patriotism based on the idea that Russia is a special and unique civilization that is Western and European, but has nothing to do with the degenerate parts of Western world and Europe, which are off further to the West.
This all gets down to the big question of what are we going to do about it and what might we do about it? What can we do about it? And what's your view of all that?
Do about what?
Shrinking the technosphere.
Oh, I think there's a lot to be done on every level. There are things in the book that policymakers should pay attention to, having to do with non-existent technology and its dangers, having to do with unlimited harm technologies that could potentially disrupt things in ways that just impossible to mitigate. All of those things are high-level problems. And then there are low-level problems of that are addressed by the harm-benefit analysis that can be practiced at the scale of the individual and the family and the community or the tribe, where people can actually wrest control over technology away from the technosphere, one element at a time.
Uh-huh. And how do we think about this at the individual level? There are, I'm sure, lots of listeners out there who are feeling sore beset by the machinations of the larger system that they have to dwell in and don't really know where to begin or what to do. What can they start thinking about? How can they, as you might put it, hack their life?
Well, one very general approach is to separate things into artifacts and flows. Artifacts are things like hand tools. They're things that you buy exactly once and then use them. If they're very well made, you may end up using them for a long time. And flows are things that require a constant flow of money and that make you dependent, that you have to keep going back. So, for instance, burdocks that grow in your backyard are basically a tool. They're artifacts that you don't have to actually tend them or anything. They just grow in a compost pile. Whereas toilet paper, which is a high-tech replacement for burdocks, is a flow because you have to keep going to the store, driving to the store, and keep having to buy more and more toilet paper. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example, but there are lots and lots of examples, simple examples like that. But once you start thinking that way, then you can start reorienting your life away from flows and towards long-lasting artifacts.
You have a subchapter in the book about the ways that we're distracting ourselves from actually undertaking this project of wresting control from the technosphere and getting it back to our own control and our own lives. Tell us something about these distractions and how they work and where they're coming from and what they represent.
Well, one of the things that the technosphere tries to do to prevent us from encroaching on it or trying to limit it is to rob us of our mental ability to do that. And distractions of various kinds are a treasured, powerful technique. So the main trick here is to not allow people to mature and grow up. You know, if you look at animals of different kinds, I don't know, lion cubs and, you know, wolf pups, whatever, they, when they're young, they play a lot, right?
Yeah.
Children too, they play a lot. And then as they mature, things get serious and they stop playing.
Uh-huh.
Now, if in traditional societies, you have the same thing. Kids can run around and do whatever they want. They're like in societies where you have strict taboos, they don't apply to children. But then there's a rite of passage. And once you assume your adult gender role within society, you no longer play. Everything becomes serious. Mm-hmm. But in this society, in societies that have been enslaved by the technosphere, we're encouraged to be lifelong game players. So sports is very important. You know, beyond physical education, you know, sports is pretty important when your body is forming, right? But why are there collegiate sports? Those are fully formed adults. Why are they still playing games in a university setting where they're supposed to be getting educated? So mm-hmm. that's just completely dumb. But if you look at it as an effort to deprive us of the mental space we need to actually address our problems, it's a powerful technique.
So this kind of explains the infantilization of the American public.
That's right. And it's throughout the world. You know, it's not just the American public. If uh-huh. if you look at the, you know, the World Cup, I think is the largest infantilization effort planet-wide. Mm-hmm. The Olympic Games are another one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's on a global scale. It's not just the United States. The United States is, you know, kind of a parochial with its strange non-football and its ball and stick game and other quaint things that nobody understands.
Not to mention the Kardashians.
Oh, of course. But those are all efforts to deprive people of the ability to think, to trivialize everything, to trivialize human interactions, to disrupt any serious conversation. You know, if there's a game on, you're not going to talk about shrinking the technosphere. You know, that's all basically driving in the same direction, making us act like foolish little children.
Well, I had my own vision of what life would be like here in the United States after the shrinkage of the technosphere in my four-book series, World Made by Hand, and I laid it out in some detail. I wonder if you have a clear vision of what the texture and feeling of the post-technosphere life might be like.
Yes and no. I've done thought experiments in various directions. There is a subchapter in the book, a section called Extreme Homesteading, mm-hmm. which details, you know, in quite a bit of detail, what it would be like to go homesteading in Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
Just go there, claim your 100 acres of land, and go and survive. Mm-hmm. And it was a really fun thing to imagine. Another kind of long-term, not even a thought experiment, it's more of a design at this point, is I'm working on a houseboat that also sails, that could be, basically a floating platform for, a semi-nomadic or a nomadic lifestyle, coastal lifestyle. It's mm-hmm. Basically a coastal boat that would do very well in all of the parts of the country that will not be exactly water and will not be exactly land as the oceans rise. You know, well, right now I'm in a place where the high tide is like 7 inches below the parking lot pretty much all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, all of these places will just basically disappear under the waves. So if your house doesn't float, okay, you're going to have to evacuate. Mm-hmm. And the only way to avoid having to evacuate is to live on a boat. But it has to be a certain kind of boat. So I've been involved in that design for a year and a half with a couple of other engineers, and that effort is going pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, I guess I want to ask, is it possible to be civilized without a technosphere as you've laid it out?
Well, civilization can mean a lot of different things. You can meet perfectly civilized people in the wildest setting. So what I'm really interested in is not civilization, but culture. And I think civilization is maybe a certain type of culture. I think civilizational links can exist even if for people who live nowhere near a city. I think that another way to look at civilizations is as distinct kinds of culture. You know, the basic underpinnings of a whole cluster of cultures form a civilization. And that's why people look at Russia, which has several hundred different ethnic groups within it, different cultures, different languages, but they all form parts of a single civilization. So there are different ways to look at it, but, you know, there is no civilized, uncivilized dichotomy that can be usefully applied. And there's no, you know, civilization with a capital C that we should be trying to preserve because it doesn't exist.
Well, okay. I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and talking about your forthcoming book, Shrinking the Technosphere. I've been talking to Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry, tell the listeners what your website is.
It's Club Orlov, ORLOV.blogspot.com.
And thank you very much for coming on. I enjoyed your book a lot. It is full of your usual mordant sense of humor, and it's beautifully written. It's well thought out, and it contains ideas that are very valuable at this moment in history. And I want to thank you for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for letting me know about Ted's new book. I'll have to find a copy.
Okay. Well, we will ride again, and I expect to be speaking to you again after the election sometime, so that we can sort that out. And thanks for coming on. Bye bye.
Thank you, Jim. Bye.